You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with actor, director, musician, and art historian, Dr. Peter Weller. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
Leon Battista Alberti. The interesting thing is that most people don't know who he is. Most people go, oh yeah, we know the Ninja Turtles, I keep referring to, the Michelangelo, Raffaello, Donatello, Leonardo. All those guys came out of Florence at one time or another. And subsequently, Florence is sort of the center of operations and so forth of the Renaissance, of what we call the Renaissance. Of course, scholars know who he is because he was a polymath, poet, painter, architect. We think he's a painter anyway. We don't have any evidence of that, but except his self-portrait, particularly an architect and a writer and a humanist. And this amazing book on painting, which, by the way, everyone has to read. There's two versions of it. There's one in Latin, and there's one in Italian translated in English. And there's a letter in front of the Italian version that thanks all of these people. Donatello, Masaccio, Ghiberti, Luca della Robbia. You have to read this. You have to read it. And the take on this letter that he's writing is that he came to Florence and wrote this amazing book in 9 months to a year. He just saw these guys and went, oh, wow, I'm going to write this book in tripartite Ciceronian Latin and bring up all of antiquity and all of these things, lines, points, measures, depth, color, these theories, and put them in a book in 1 year because I came to Florence and saw these guys. I say, you know, pardon the expression on your podcast, horse shit. And so when I read this, all these takes on what Alberti did, that's the thing that got me jammed on this, on Alberti. Because it's the first modern book on painting. It's in three parts. I'm a mediocre to poor Latinist, but I'm a Cicero obsessive, and I'm a Quintilian obsessive. I still don't know enough. I read those guys all the time. But his sources of the Latin guys and his sources of Greco-Roman gifts to art and architecture. You know, come on, man. This guy didn't come to Florence to write this book in 9 months. I walk around asking these professors, and it's funny, you know, because I'm asking of some famous people from England all the way to Italy. I go, guys, you know, the inference here is that he came to Florence and went, wow, wrote this book. And everyone, I talked to 20 people, everyone except one, said, Peter, everybody knows that. I said, well, why isn't it taught? It's not taught. It's taught that he comes to Florence and becomes a smarty pants. Why isn't his history taught? They go, why don't you teach it? Five of these guys said, you write it. I said, you want me to be the scapegoat here, man, for like 40 people to come out of the woodwork? And by the way, art history competition is truly pretentious and very aggravating, as you well know.
I know a little bit about academia.
Yeah, like what Henry Kissinger just said, there's so much competition in academia because there's so little at stake, right? I have to say, I was the ugly American. I mean, I was Mark Twain's version of it. I was sent to Italy essentially by Ali. I was amazed and confused and dazed and so forth, but I would run through Italy absorbing its food essentially and its buildings and looking at the art, but not ever trying to understand it. And there were places that I warned people away from. I mean, I warned people for 8 years. I warned people away from Venice. Don't go to Venice. It's a puke hole. It's overloaded with tourists. It's like that, la, la, la. It's a, you know, who wants to go? I was skimming the top of the culture of Europe, and I was embarrassed into learning the language some years after by a great friend of mine, Philippe Colon, French-Lebanese, who said, Peter, you know, we come to United States and we all speak English and you come to Paris. You go to Rome, we all speak English. I thought, gosh. I called up Ali. I said, look, you speak five languages. What do I do here? I've been going to Italy for 8 years now, man. I don't speak any of this stuff, man. She goes, yeah, get a kid, get somebody, get whoever to come to your house. And A, don't miss the lesson. And B, even if you don't do the homework or whatever, don't miss the lesson. And you got to be willing to make an ass out of yourself to learn a language. Thank God my mother took me to see the Berlin Philharmonic do Beethoven's Ninth. Thank God my mother took me to see the flamenco reunion of, you know, all the great flamenco dancers. And thank God my mother took me to see Jazz at the Philharmonic. I didn't want to go to any of this stuff. Thank God my mother made me play music. My mother was the cultural addict. But thank God my dad gave me the discipline to get up and go. And my dad was the guy who always said, you got to go to Italy. He called it Italy, right? So you think you're eating Italian food? Says, you got to go to Italy, sit on the streets of Rome and have them bring it out to you in a frying pan. And I wish more Americans would do it. You know, I did a seminar at 16th Century Society on Renaissance art to modern film. And that's like, people went in those churches to see the Sistine Chapel or whatever. There's the Medici. There's the writers. There's it was a movie to them. It was a movie. You have essentially a, many times it's not illiterate. People are starting to learn again, but learn reading. An illiterate crowd who want to go in and learn by vision. And so those are movies, man. You get somebody lead you by the hand. And as Ernst Gombrich said, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said, you know, this thing that also makes me weepy, you don't know what you like. It's not that you don't know what you like. You don't know what you like. If somebody takes you by the hand and walks you through it, walks you through the connective tissue of all the imagery on a cave all the way up to Piet Mondrian, you're going to like it. It may not be your favorite, but you're certainly going to get your head around it. A banker stood with me in the middle of my cigar club saying, I don't get these big black squares. I said, I walked him backwards through Cubism into, real simply, Cezanne. And Cezanne took Impressionism and he edged it with black. You know, usually all this green or all these fields going up a mountain. You go, what is with that? When you look closer, he's edged every single square, rectangle, triangle in it. And you see the mathematics of the thing jump out. And I'm walking him back to that. And then I walk him back to Piero della Francesca, who Cezanne sourced because della Francesca was the guy who said, nature is all mathematical. If you look a little bit longer, you'll see the perfect mathematics in a leaf, the perfect mathematics in a tree, an acorn, everything has the perfect mathematics, which is God-given. Later on, you see that the framing of film, the great framing of films is the great shots of film, particularly from Italy, those guys. Doesn't matter, we're talking to Rossellini all the way up to De Sica, Fellini, Antonioni, on. They knew how to frame because they're looking at art. Scorsese knows how to frame because he looks at art. Coppola knows how to frame because he looks at art. So looking at the art will tell you what to shoot or how to shoot it. I did a thing as a graduate. It was a graduate project by taking undergrads through four of the Last Suppers in Florence. And there's a Ghirlandaio, and there's a Del Sarto, and there's a Castagno, and there's Taddeo Gaddi, and from all the way through the early stages of the Renaissance, and how they frame the Last Supper, and how they set up the drama of the Last Supper, and who is who in the Last Supper, and what the color scheme is of these Last Suppers. And one of them that a lot of people in San Apollonia, the one of the Castagno, my favorite one, you got to Google this, Castagno, Last Supper, Florence. Look at the explosion of contemporary art in that thing and the framing of it. And so that's a framing story right there. That's all movies. It's all movies. I'm going to read you something. Just will give you a lowdown on what it is that feeds me. If I could just read you this beginning. Okay, this is called Flourish of an Outsider, a panel on Venetian outsiders from Venice, Renaissance Society of America, which is essentially the world Renaissance. This Flourish of an Outsider, the Brief Brilliance of Antonello da Messina. Okay, here it is. As a Johnny come lately to Renaissance art, in gratitude to Vittorio Storaro, Maria Connelli, and the late wonderful Walter Lead Cave, the Metropolitan Museum in New York, when I first saw the Ecce Homo, that's Here is Man, it comes out of the Book of John, where Jesus is held up to the crowd. I first saw the Ecce Homo at the Met. And you guys should Google this. Ecce Homo, Metropolitan Museum in New York. You see this boxer, a pugilist, as Jesus with a bad mustache. Is he handsome? No. Does he look like Robert Redford? No. Does he have blonde hair? No. Does he look like a thug? Yeah. When I first saw the Ecce Homo at the Met, executed in Venice by Antonello da Messina, that painter instantly became my own private Idaho. Poo-pooed later on, and this is in the 1990s, by the way, poo-pooed later on by graduate classmates as second tier compared to the Florence and its Ninja Turtles of Raffaello, etc. My jam was akin to heralding Bob Dylan as a real-life poet, the real-deal poet, in the face of, in 1960s, of Cummings or Eliot or Wallace Stevens, etc. Subsequently, thanks to the 21st century bringing around events like Keith Curtis and Andrea Barra at the Met's 2005 poignant exhibit, and Mauro Luco's brilliant 2000 show at the Scuderia di Cornali in Rome, as well as a plethora of 21st century scholarship and revived stuff, Antonello has enjoyed a fresh blast of merited attention and now seems to be everybody's pet painter of the Renaissance, which honestly, I resent a bit. But then again, Bob Dylan won the 2016 Literature Nobel Prize as a poet, no less. So the point of this is that everybody's idea of the thing is not the thing. It's, you got to step out of the bubble. You know, my whole thing is thanks to my mother is jazz. My whole obsession. That's how I got to meet Miles, because every time I was interviewed for a movie, I would turn the conversation back to jazz and start talking about Miles or Coltrane or Duke or somebody. And so by the time I met Miles, Miles knew he had a sucker walking in, you know, because all these people, because by that time I knew Herbie Hancock, I knew Wayne Shorter, I knew Ron Carter, I knew all the greats, man. And they'd all told him, you know, this actor guy is constantly talking about you. So he knew he had like a total sycophant walking in that dressing room. But Treat, bless his heart, you know, because my language has always been with man and cool and jazz and bop and the rebop of jazz talk. And Treat said, Peter, you know what? You know who you really are? You're a middle-class white boy posing as a black hipster. I said, Treat, you know what? I think you pinned me, man. I think that's going to stay with me forever. I am a middle-class white boy posing as a black hipster. And with that, it's going to make me, I promise myself I won't weep. But the thing, I think it's in the diary, but my mom said that if I was God, because I walked Miles Davis to his car with Bob Field Jr., whose dad produced Train. And we're backstage at Hollywood Bowl, the last gig he ever played. And Miles asked me, who's that white boy? I said, it's Bob Field Jr., great music supervisor. He says, his dad produced Train? I said, yeah. Walked up to Bob and said, you know, your father took Coltrane out of my band. I said, yeah. He says, your father produced Train? He says, yeah. He says, well, you can hang and permission. And we walked out. I did not know he was dying. I did not know he was sick. I kissed him on both cheeks, and 18 days later, he was dead. And I told my mother that. My mother said, you know, if I was God and I was thinking of somebody to say goodbye for all of us, I say that in the thing. You know, who better than a white boy? I've been listening to him since he was 11. People are worried about the world now, man. Go live in 1968 and see what that was like, with everybody preparing to go to the moon at the same time, man. People dying on the streets for what they believed in. A difficult time in a republic to die. Difficult time in a republic that's supposed to be free when you're just going to die. It doesn't matter what your political philosophy is. But music was leading the way. And if it wasn't a new album, it doesn't matter what it was. Whether it was Miles or Coltrane or Aretha or Leonard Cohen or Dylan or the Stones or the Beatles or Hendrix or Cream or Velvet Underground. Out of that, about 71, we get Ramones and so forth. Extraordinarily influential music. It's on the cutting. It's way before theater arts. It's way before dance arts. Way before poetic or literature arts. That music, there was an album, a Zappa, a something coming out every month. There was something. And it was all interpretive, it was all inside you. And it riled you and made you happy and sad at the same time. And man, I couldn't believe Otis has got a new album out now. It's what you just said, Mia. Art transcends a time and culture. That's the beauty of it. I mean, I was just in Japan, like, 9 months ago, once again, looking at the art and looking at the dance, and we saw this whole kabuki theater piece, which you have to pay big money and have to wait in line, have to buy it and wait in advance. And I think, my God, the sounds and the drums and musical instruments and the absolute harmony of this chaos, because it sounds to the Western ear like chaos, but it's actually harmonious. That transcends culture, it transcends time, it transcends all of it. I think that's maybe that is the greatest gift of art, transcendence.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.